I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
We recognize that for ourselves as well. After you have eaten something from a fast food, 1 hour later, you already feel hunger again. This study really shows how well that the satiety signal is much less.
Still, you see so many people going on a diet, but just healthy eating is one of the elements you can do yourself for healthy living. Actually, it's not the solution for obesity only, dieting only, eating healthy. It's much more is necessary if you are really living with obesity already.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, the show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. Fat, this curious, wonderful, and often misunderstood organ is the subject of today's podcast with Professor Lisbeth van Rossum and Dr. Mariette Boone, authors of the incredible book, Fat, the Secret Organ. And yes, it is an organ. Professor Lisbeth van Rossum is an internist endocrinologist at the Erasmus University Medical Center, Rotterdam. She's also co-founder of the Obesity Center and has an internationally leading position in the field of obesity and biological stress research. Dr. Mariette Boone is an internal medicine specialist in training, and her research performed at the Leiden University focuses on fat metabolism. And honestly, today's conversation is a whirlwind running through a fantastic variety of topics all to do with fat. You're going to learn about why fat is in an organ, what mechanisms drive hunger and satiety, how you can stimulate satiety to eat less, why stress can cause fat, why liposuction unfortunately does not work, the number and size of fat cells and if they change throughout your life, as well as fat on inflammation, immune health, and fertility. It is an incredible conversation, and their book, Fat, the Secret Organ, is a must read for anyone interested in this subject. We didn't get time to deep dive into some of the other topics in their book, such as the evidence-based lifestyle recommendations, but I highly recommend you get a copy, and I think you're going to find today's conversation super, super useful. Remember, you can join the newsletter where I share three things to help you live a healthier, happier life every single week, something to eat, read, or listen to, and you'll get a free 7-day meal plan as well when you sign up at thedoctorskitchen.com. For now, here is my conversation with Professor Lisbeth and Dr. Mariette Boone. Professor, Doctor, thank you so much for joining me in the podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you both here. I notice in both of your biographies, I believe, Lisbeth, you are an athletics fanatic. Is that right?
Oh, that's right. Yes, yeah. I love long jump and I love sprinting, but I'm not a long distance, not an endurance athlete, to be honest. Yeah.
I've tried to be endurance myself in the past, actually. Like, I've done a half marathon.
Oh,
but
really?
I've never completed a marathon. Yeah, I think a marathon is a bit pushing it for me.
I admire that so much. People who are able to run a marathon, a half a marathon. I really like to stand in the audience and shout it and help them. But 100 meters is for me more than enough. And long jump over 30 meters is already long enough. I like the reactive and the high speed athletics.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Those fast muscle twitch fibers. And Mariette, you're a tennis fan as well.
Oh, yes. Currently, I am more into watching the tennis. But also, of course, due to the corona regulations, it's more difficult to play it yourself. But yeah, I really love to play tennis. Also, as Lisbeth mentioned, the very fast movements, I really like that. Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, I mean, your book is absolutely fantastic. We were talking a bit about before the show started recording about how the book is being used in policy decisions across both medicine as well as people who don't have a medical background being able to access it. I think it's fantastically written. My question to start off with is how you guys both came to obesity and everything to do with fat as a research area yourselves. Where was that interest peaked for you both?
Yeah, for me, it already started, I guess, during my medical study. Myself, I am, I used to be very thin always, and I didn't really understand why. That fascinated me because I always eat a lot. I also exercise a lot, but that really intrigues me. And the other way around intrigues me as well. How can it be that some people so easily can gain weight? How does it work? And yeah, that really started my interest for this research area. And it never let go of me.
Yeah, I think for me, it also started during med school already. I think in the 90s, I was also doing athletics then. And some people were very, just in a few trainings, they started to gain muscle mass, and some still kept a layer of fat. And actually, my mother was overweight, and she was always busy with dieting. And you know, she was cooking healthy for the rest of the family, but she was always in weird kind of dieting. And later on, and I understood there were some underlying causes making her fat. And then in the 90s, when I was in med school, then the leptin was just discovered. And I won an award to go to the US doing at the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins University, doing some research there. And there, a whole field appeared to me that it's such an interesting world, that obesity is really complex, and that fat is an organ secreting hormones. I mean, that was so fascinating. And then I understood when I went back to the Netherlands and finished my studies, well, I said, we have to do more with concerning research here.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. And right at the start of the book, what I really appreciated was the history surrounding fat and how it's more recently transitioned from something that we thought as something as desirable to something that is sort of like public enemy number one, but also throughout the stages of our evolution, how important and necessary fat was. I wonder if we can talk briefly about that sort of the anthropological aspect of fat.
Yeah, that really fascinates me as well, because of course the evolutionary purpose of our body fat is it is a large storage organ for nutrients. And well, our ancestors did not always have access to food. So yeah, we are really as humans dependent on our fat stores. So we have enough fat stores to go without food for about 40 or 50 days, depending on how much you move, of course. But it's a very important store. So it was really appreciated by our ancestors. And there is some art, some small statues of a woman. We also show that in the book, of a woman who has, well, a lot of body fat. And that was really appreciated. It's sort of the white gold in your body. And as you mentioned, also during the 17th, 18th century, it was sort of, well, when you had a lot of money, you could buy a lot of food, you had a very big posture, that was really appreciated. But indeed, in the 20th century, it became clear that it is unhealthy to have too much fat. Mm. And from that on, it was seen as more of an enemy. And also, previously, people who had a lot of fat were thought to be kind. They were described also in literature back then. They were jolly fat people. They were very kind. And later on, that shifted. They were dumb. They were not kind at all. And well, that's really really fascinating, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting to see that and how art and culture and literature has sort of changed the perspective that we have of people of different weight categories and aesthetic categories as well. I wonder, I mean, the title of the book, the subtitle is The Secret Organ. And this whole concept of fat being an organ, I think, is relatively new. Lisbeth, can you describe about what we mean by fat being an organ?
Yeah, I think it's important that people indeed realize that that's an active hormone-producing organ. More than hundreds of hormones are being produced in the fat, but also all kinds of substances which are important, for example, the immune system. And there's a great communication between the fat mass, communication between the brain, between other organs, also the intestines. To realize that it's an organ, you can easier also understand that when you have too much fat, that's a disease, that the whole communication between the organ fat and the brain, for example, is disturbed. And it's crucial. This communication is so important because so too much fat is basically making you sick, like or heart or liver can be sick, but also your fat can be sick. And it's also now in Europe, it's being called a chronic relapsing disease. And that's important because once your fat is sick, the body becomes sort of reprogrammed that if you have a high weight, that the body wants always to go up to the higher weight again. And therefore, the combating obesity is so hard. And at the same time, it's also called a gateway disease because 230 complications have been described from obesity. And the most known, of course, are type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, but also 13 forms of cancer, for example, are obesity-related. Depression, because also these inflammatory factors can also signal to the brain, and also these hormones, they give also brain disturbances, mood disorders. Infertility can exist, joint complaints, but also more severe course of infections, for example, like we see nowadays with COVID-19. So those are the most known complications, but there are so many more. So it's both a gateway disease to other diseases, but when you have too much fat itself, it changes within the communication between fat and brain and other organs. So that's really important to realize.
Mm, yeah. And I, in the book, you also talk about how some people have too little fat as well. There's a curious, throughout the whole book, you've got examples and patient stories, I think, which are really helpful to contextualize everything. So can you go through some of the descriptions of how people actually suffer from conditions where they have too little fat? Because I think most people are aware of why too much fat is a bad thing, but perhaps the other side of things is lesser known.
Well, we do describe in the book, it is very rare, though, that you have a certain condition in which you don't have any subcutaneous fat. Mm. And that can also be very unhealthy because, as Lisbeth mentioned in the beginning, our fat produces hundreds of hormones, and one of them is leptin. And when you don't have any subcutaneous fat, your leptin levels are really low. And leptin is a crucial hormone for all kinds of processes in the body. And that can make it very dangerous. And also, when you don't have any subcutaneous fat, where do you have to store your fat? This will be stored in other organs, like the liver, like the heart. And these organs start to malfunction. So therefore, you do need your body fat. But what is much more known is, of course, the disease anorexia nervosa, where people have a very little body fat, or people who have little body fat for other reasons. And well, that can also be unhealthy because of this hormone leptin, because leptin is produced, well, when you have a lot of body fat, a lot of leptin is produced. And when you have little body fat, only little leptin is produced. And when the amount of leptin is low, this has several consequences, because in women, a certain amount of leptin is needed for women to keep menstruating. So this happens via a connection of leptin to the fertility center in the brain. So then women stop menstruating, and it has been studied that women need about 17% of body fat to keep menstruating. And it is also very important, leptin, for the function of our immune cells. So too little fat can also result in various serious infections and also more fragile bones. So this, I think, well, really illustrates the importance of our body fat. You cannot go without it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think I don't think many people have really thought about it from the perspective of your immune system and fertility as well. And I guess just to take it a step backwards, let's talk a bit about those hormones, leptin, ghrelin, where they're produced, how they're produced, what they're produced in response to those hunger hormones. How does that network work?
Yeah, I think it's good also to realize that we make a lot of food choices a day. Over 200 food choices we make, and by far the majority is unconscious. And indeed, these hunger hormones and satiety hormones, they play a big role in that. And for example, if you get hungry and your stomach is empty, your hunger hormone ghrelin is being produced from the stomach, and it makes you extra hungry. And then when you start eating, also your satiety hormones, basically most of them in the intestines, are being produced in response to food intake. And they signal to the brain and they give you feelings of fullness. So it's not only we always think we stop eating because the stomach is being stretched and then we stop eating. Well, it's part of the story, though, because of the vagal nerve, the signal to the brain. But a large part of your satiety, feeling full, is determined by satiety hormones. And that's really important because they can be disturbed if you have too much fat, for example. This communication is being disturbed. Also, from the fat, we have the hormone leptin. And leptin has multiple functions, actually. It's an acute hormone. It can inhibit food intake, stimulate metabolism, which is really important as acute effect. But at the same time, it's also a adiposity marker. So it's basically a sort of scale of how much fat do you have in the body as storage. And this feeling full, you're really full by your satiety hormones. We call that a homeostatic system, and you can be really full. But you can sometimes really eat through it, though. For example, when something is really delicious, like a dessert, for example, if you have a major Christmas dinner and you had meals, but somehow this dessert still fits. And that is through a different system. We call it the hedonic system. So it's basically your reward system, which also is related to the hypothalamus, which is the major center in the brain regulating all these hormones. It's receiving hormones, but it's also sending signals. And the hedonic system is involving other neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. And they make you feel very comfortable. If you eat a dessert, you just like it so much, and then this center is active. So through this center, that's the reason that the dessert still fits, although your satiety hormones are on. But you can actually influence this, and this happens all day, actually. If we are walking outside, for example, to a central station and we take a train, all around us, the food environment is with posters or smells of delicious things which are not healthy, like donuts or anything. You can try it yourself right now. If you imagine maybe now a large chocolate bar being just in front of you right now, and if you really think of it and you start to get hungry, maybe you should visualize it now. And then automatically also your hunger hormone ghrelin will be produced, but also your insulin, for example, will be produced. And if insulin is being produced, your glucose will go lower, your sugar in your blood will, the levels will go lower. And then you get sort of craving for something sweet. And when we then would go out to grab something to eat, we are much more prone to take something sweet than maybe an healthy piece of bread or anything, because we are sort of programmed to take this sweet already. So that's what influences. So we can influence it ourselves, but our environment is also influencing it heavily. And I think a very good example of that is also the very famous mind over milkshake experiment, and that's seems almost magical that our thoughts can also influence, for example, our ghrelin levels. This experiment is being performed by a psychologist at Yale University. They gave 46 research participants a milkshake, and it contained 380 kilocalories. And half of the participants were told that it was a high-calorie milkshake with 620 calories. And the other half, they were told it was a sensible milkshake with only 140 calories. And then the researchers, they took blood from the participants at various time points to measure their ghrelin levels. And then in between the two blood groups, the participants had to examine and to evaluate this basically incorrect milkshake label. Then when they were asked to drink the milkshake and to re-evaluate it, and then there was really striking. The analysis showed that the mindset of the people who believed they had been giving a high caloric milkshake, that resulted in a sharp drop of their ghrelin levels. But in contrast, the ghrelin levels of those who believed they had drunk a much lighter version of the shake, they remained virtually unchanged. So likewise, the physical reaction with respect to the hunger hormone ghrelin was more strongly associated with the number of calories thought they had consumed than actually the actual calories. So actually, these researchers concluded from the effect of our food on ghrelin that's probably mediated by the mind. So I think it's so interesting that our mindset can influence our response also to food. And I think that that's also what's going on right now in our food environment.
That was absolutely fascinating. I love that description of the experiment. And just for listeners to think about, like, how many different pathways are involved in satiety and appetite regulation. We have leptin and ghrelin being released from various places, whether it be your stomach or your fat cells. Then you have the mechanoreceptors, which is the stretching of your digestive organs, which also has an impact on your hormone release, your hedonic pathway, as well as the perception of what you're eating as well. I mean, all these things interplay into whether we overeat, whether we eat healthier items. You have a lovely checklist, I think, in the book about how you can influence your own feelings of satiety. I wonder if we could talk about that for a second.
Yeah, well, that's indeed very interesting, because you can trick that in so many ways. As Lisbeth mentioned, there are a lot of pathways that eventually result in feeling of satiety. What is also produced after you have eaten a meal are intestinal hormones, so even more hormones. And one of the intestinal hormones is GLP-1. Mm-hmm. And this hormone can also induce a feeling of satiety. And it takes about 20 minutes before GLP-1 is produced by the intestine. And well, if you try to eat slow, if you try to chew more on your food, that makes it less likely that you will eventually eat a second plate of food, because, well, you then already feel satiety already after your first plate. What you can also do is try to eat from a smaller plate, because the optical illusion helps you feel fuller. So you can also trick that with your mind. And what you can also do is choose unprocessed food products as often as possible. I think that's a very important one, because these induce a better satiety signal compared to ultra-processed food, which is, well, basically in all the supermarkets lying everywhere.
I think in addition to that, it's very interesting that, Kevin Hall's group did a fascinating experiment on that. It was a randomized controlled trial where he studied 20 persons with a body mass index of 27, and they were given both groups exactly the same amount of food with respect to calorie number, but also the fiber, salt, carbohydrates, fat, everything, the macronutrients were similar in two groups. But the only difference was that one group was being given the ultra-processed food and the other group was unprocessed food. So basically the food you can still recognize as a cauliflower is a cauliflower, and the other food is more processed. And within 2 weeks, they noticed that the group who was eating ultra-processed food, on average, they eat faster and 508 calories a day more than the group who was eating unprocessed. And within the 2 weeks, also, they gained 1 kilogram of weight. In contrast to the group who eat only unprocessed food, they lost actually 1 kilogram of 1 kilogram of weight within the 2 weeks. And I think it's fascinating because it perfectly controls all the circumstances, which is quite unique. And of course, it's only the short term, but it's showing some causal relation between the only different unprocessed food. Because we always have discussion about kilocalories and should it be low carb, low fat. And this is showing there are probably also other mechanisms. And also interesting in this experiment was that he was showing that unprocessed food, then you see a very nice decrease of the hunger hormone ghrelin, which should be your hunger hormone, should be decreasing if you eat after eating. And at the same time, one of the most important satiety hormones, the PYY, peptide-YY, was increasing. But this beautiful response of the body was not present when people were eating ultra-processed food. So maybe the mechanism of eating too much ultra-processed food might be mediated by disturbing our hunger and satiety hormones. So that's new insights, which were very important, I think.
It's really fascinating because we recognize that for ourselves as well. After you have eaten something from a fast food, 1 hour later, you already feel hunger again. This study really shows how well that the satiety signal is much less.
That is super interesting because I think a lot of the discussion that you see dominated on social media and even in academic forums are about different types of macronutrient profiles of food, which one is better versus which one is, you know, more scientifically valid. I always like to think about Occam's razor. The simplest approach is usually going to be the most effective and probably the most truthful as well. So simply moving people along that spectrum from ultra high processed to unprocessed food is likely the way we need to think about all dietary approaches, and the mechanisms that back up that are like, you know, shown in that experiment right there. I mean, that for me is a real sort of bold underlining of the simple approach.
Yeah, I think you have a major point right now, because we see now in our offices, if we see patients living with obesity, completely the opposite happens, because a lot of people are being told, if you should lose weight, so go on a diet. And the ones who are really eager to lose weight, what do? They do crash dieting, for example, lower than 800 or even 500 kilocalories. And shocking about that was, I think, revolutionary research of the famous Sumitron article from Australia, showing that already after a couple of weeks of crash dieting, that people, of course, they lost weight. And it doesn't matter which diet you do, if you go low in that, so low in the calories, you will lose weight on the short term, so not long term, actually. But what happens is already after a couple of weeks that they notice that the hunger hormones increase in the satiety hormones, some of the hormones which make you feel full, they decreased. And the shocking thing about the paper, which shocked the world at that time, actually, that these persons were retested more than 1 year later. So they were already finished with their crash dieting. They eat normally, but still these disturbances were still this in the same way. And when your satiety hormones are decreased, well, you're more basically more hungry. And we also know that your metabolism slows down from crash dieting. So when you're more hungry and your metabolism slows down, well, that's the perfect prescription, actually, the perfect formula to regain your weight. And that's usually what happens for people. And I feel really sorry for my patients who I've been doing for 10 times crash dieting, and one even stricter than the other. And they are sort of destroying your own system. The only solution can be, if you really want to do a crash diet, then you should directly after change your behavior to a healthy behavior. Then it can work, but not if you do only like a short-term crash dieting and then your old behavior. That's really not what's working. And So that's our insight. So just eating healthy is important. We recently also did a study. People underwent a combined lifestyle intervention. So by 1.5 year coaching on healthy living, exercise, but also cognitive behavioral therapy. And also their diet was just as much as possible unprocessed food, normal, healthy diet. And then we noticed that most of these acute hunger and satiety hormones were not disturbed, actually. So therefore we have more and more evidence that just healthy, it seems very clear, of course, but still you see so many people going on a diet, but just healthy eating is one of the elements you can do yourself for healthy living. Actually, it's not the solution for obesity only, dieting only, eating healthy. It's much more is necessary if you are really living with obesity already. But that's another story.
It's one of those tools that we need to entertain, but it's not at the expense of everything else, because as we know, and as you talk about in your book, about the associations with mental health disorders, low mood, anxiety, as well as a number of other physical issues too that you described earlier, those are things that we also need to take into account. And I think it's a lovely segue into the bit about inflammation and fat. And adiponectins as well. I wonder if we can talk about adiponectins for a little while. It's a relatively new thing that people are coming across. Can we describe what those are and how that relates to inflammation?
Yeah, actually, leptin is one of the major fat hormones, which is basically pro-inflammatory. And adiponectin, we see it actually as a beneficial hormone. It's with respect to inflammation, it's anti-inflammatory. And what we see actually in people living with obesity, that the leptin levels are increased because it's a marker of the amount of body fat. So more pro-inflammatory. And at the same time, we see a decrease of the adiponectin, which is anti-inflammatory. And that disbalance is really important as one of the factors making the fat cells, which are increased in obesity, that they are pro-inflammatory. And that is one of the major mechanisms leading to, for example, insulin resistance, but also cardiovascular disease, cancer, depression, all these gateway disease complications of obesity. Inflammation is a major part in that. And therefore, also you see when people are decreasing their weight, when it's either by lifestyle intervention, pharmacotherapy, or bariatric surgery, that the degree of inflammation is also lowering. And one of the points what we see right now is that when inflammation is continuously present, that also affects the immune system. And you have like two layers of immune system. You have your innate immune system that's basically always, that's when you're born, it's present. And then you have your adaptive immune system. And if you, for example, catch a virus or bacteria, then the adaptive immune system after a couple of days will recognize it and will produce, for example, antibodies against it. And both these immune systems are being disturbed in people with obesity basically because they are too much active all the time already, combating all these inflammatory factors. And then what you see is if people with obesity have a chronically active, overactive immune system, then when a virus is coming up over it, then the immune system is not ready enough to combat the virus, for example. And that's one of the aspects, really not the only one, because there are very many other ways leading to more severe infections. But it's also one of the ways leading to a more severe course of, for example, COVID-19 in patients suffering from obesity.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I guess to simplistically summarize, because your threshold for inflammation is so much higher already because of the leptin levels, when you do need to mount an immune response, you don't have the armory essentially to fight against pathogens. So that could be one of the reasons. And then conversely, when you're dealing with a multi-system inflammatory disease, such as the one caused by COVID, again, that adds to your inflammatory burden as well, which can lead to a whole bunch of complications. And you mentioned this in the book. I think one person listening to this might think, okay, well, if you have these fat cells and they're all creating inflammation, why don't you just suck a few out using liposuction to reduce the number of fat cells that are producing leptin? What is the science around the number and the type of fat cells and the issues around that sort of simplistic argument for liposuction?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that will not work. Your body is surprisingly good at keeping the amount of fat cells constant. We don't really know how that works, but we do know that it works because we know from studies that when you perform liposuction and literally, well, suck out fat cells, the fat cells grow back at a different place. So in part of the woman who have undergone liposuction, we see that, fat cells grow back in the breast, for example. It's not always a really bad thing for everybody, but it shows that your body really wants to keep the fat cells constant. So it does, well, it will not work by removing fat cells.
Yeah, and actually the fat cells itself, when you're getting obese, then the fat cells grow, and when you lose weight, they become smaller, but the number of fat cells is constant. So it's fascinating that the body is doing that. And the good news about the immune system, actually, if one of the ways, rather than liposuction, one of the ways to decrease, for example, this inflammation is, for example, a combined lyso intervention. We recently showed in a study where people who are living with obesity lost weight, and it was really only about 5%, so not spectacular. Afterwards, they had still obesity, but already after a couple of weeks, by exercising more, not extremely, but normal exercising, eating healthy, and psychological therapy, then already this innate and adaptive immune system, we saw better regulation. And also after 1.5 years, on the long time, these improvements continued. So you can do something about this pro-inflammatory status yourself. And I think in pandemics, like with viruses, it's also important to realize that within a couple of weeks, you can already do something about your health and protect yourself naturally with respect to the immune system by just living healthy. And you don't have to reach a healthy weight, but a healthier weight is already good.
Yeah, I think what Lisbeth stresses is really important, the fact that already losing 5 to 10% of your body weight is really healthy. Some people think, well, I have to lose so much kilos, it will never work. But really, it's important that when you lose 5 to 10%, not only your immune system improves, but also your glucose metabolism already can markedly improve after losing 5 to 10% of body weight. So, well, I think that changes the way you can set goals for yourself.
Yeah,
this is already a very good first goal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just, you know, having those small sustainable goals in mind rather than these drastic sort of calorie cutting exercises where you have these incredible transformations that you see within 60 days. Although it might seem desirable to a lot of people, it's not necessarily at the healthiest intervention, particularly when you follow those people up for 12 months and you see a weight resetting and it leads to yo-yo dieting. And I think also that the impact of those healthier lifestyle interventions, not just on fat composition, but also on immune system and the capabilities for you to fight off infections, I think, again, should be another sort of hook for people to think about with these health healthy lifestyle changes. You mentioned the fat cell number and the size of those and how those change. And the curious sort of observation that we see where you remove fat cells and they pop up somewhere else. What determines the distribution of fat? I think some people have come across the concept of apple shapes versus pear shaped bodies. Is there a particular component, maybe something genetic, that determines people's sizes and shapes?
Yeah, actually, the amount of body fat and how prone you are to develop obesity is most of that in your genes anyway. It's actually surprising right now. You see, in Europe, almost 60% is overweight right now. But when you consider the environment, it's surprising that not almost 100% is overweight, because the majority of the people is not living healthy right now. So some people are protected from developing obesity and some are more prone to obesity. So that's in general. But then where the fat is stored is indeed also for a part already genetically determined. For example, when fat is stored around the waist, that's even more genetically determined, but also other influences like hormonal influences. We see as known that males store fat more easily around their abdominal region, and women more on the subcutaneous, on their hips, for example, subcutaneous fat, which is basically healthy. We know the visceral fat in the abdominal region is more the unhealthy fat, producing more of these pro-inflammatory factors and hormones. But also during life, you see that with aging, that women, when they are postmenopausal, they change also their estrogens and testosterone balance. Yes, women also have testosterone. They're produced in their adrenal glands and their ovaries. But their ovaries obviously are not working anymore after the menopause. And you see alterations in their hormonal balances, and they are also more prone to develop abdominal obesity after menopause. And another important factor can be medication use or the stress hormone cortisol, which makes you also more store fat around the abdominal region. And so there are many more factors also helping to determine where the fat is being stored. And you see it also in families that just as height is partly genetically determined, it also weight and where you store your fat is. There's a high polygenetic factor around that.
I was interested to know actually that there is a cortisol sensitive gene variant, which gives people a particular propensity towards stress induced fat as well. That's something I haven't come across before.
Yeah, actually, there was actually the topic of my PhD thesis. That's interesting because we know that too much of the stress hormone cortisol, it does not only cause more abdominal fat in general, but it also causes that you are longing for more high caloric food, more hungry, but especially high caloric food. So maybe you will recognize it if you're very stressed, that you rather grab a chocolate bar than maybe a healthy apple. And also sugar-rich foods can also increase your stress hormone cortisol. So sometimes like a vicious circle can exist, either starting by stress, making you more hungry, or starting to eat unhealthy and contributing to higher cortisol levels. So that's in general. But we know that some people lose weight from being stressed, and some people from chronically being stressed, they gain weight. And actually the majority is gaining weight. And part of that is indeed being also genetically determined. Because cortisol needs a receptor, so a sort of receiver, which is present on basically every cell in our body. And this receptor of cortisol can be either hypersensitive, relatively more sensitive, or you can a little bit be decreased sensitive for your own cortisol. And what we found in studies is that about 40-45% of the population, of the Western population, is relatively more sensitive to your own stress hormone cortisol. And we indeed found relations with a more abdominal fat mass, higher blood pressure, higher cholesterol level, higher cholesterol levels. And in contrast, about 6 to maybe 10% is relatively insensitive for cortisol. And indeed, those are people who become, on average, taller. In males, we found more muscle mass. In women, we found a smaller waist circumference and protection or relationship with lower insulin, lower cholesterol levels. But also lower risk on dementia, for example. So some are more prone to suffer from stress hormone than others. Maybe they experience the same amount of stress, but how the signal is being translated at the cellular level can be different per person.
That is fascinating. I really find that interesting because someone's response to stress can be in part genetically determined as to whether this is going to have a beneficial or a negative impact on your physiology. And I read also that it has effect on brown fat as well and the metabolism within brown fat. And that leads me on to talk about brown fat because I think people have heard through the ether that brown fat is something that is good. But I wonder if we could talk about how brown fat was discovered and why it's beneficial. Mariette, maybe you can...
Yeah, well, brown fat was actually the topic of my PhD thesis.
Oh, lovely. So I didn't know this before. This is working very well.
Very well done. It was discovered... we know for ages that it is already present in certain animals and also in babies. And, well, first, what brown fat basically does is it's sort of an internal heater. So it's a type of fat, but it only stores a little fat. What it mainly does is it burns fat towards heat. So it's, an internal heater. And the main physiological stimulus to activate brown fat is cold. So our ancestors also needed a lot of brown fat because they were not only exposed to a lot of hunger, but also to a lot of cold. So next to our muscles, we have this brown fat organ to keep ourselves warm. Well, we know that also babies have a lot of brown fat because they have a relatively large head from which they can lose a lot of heat. So therefore, they are really dependent on their brown fat to keep themselves warm because babies don't have that much muscle, so they cannot really, really shiver. And we thought until about 15 years ago that, the brown fat disappears when we grow older because, we have our muscle, we don't need it anymore. But it appeared from certain, nuclear studies that we still have brown fat. So in nuclear medicine, when we are looking for cancer in people, we can give people a tracer, a radioactively labeled glucose-like label. And this glucose is taken up by organs that have a very large metabolism, such as cancer cells. And in that way, when you give that tracer to people, when it's taken up by certain spots in the body, you can... you can see that can be either cancer or it can be either inflammation. And it appeared about 15 years ago that when people received this type of, because you give that tracer followed by a PET scan, and that people, when they got this PET scan in winter times, there were whole strokes of uptake of glucose in the neck and along the large vessels. Well, that could not be cancer, of course. So they took a biopsy of it, and then it appeared that it were actually sort of fat cells. And then it was known that we still have brown fat. So that's really interesting because, of course, in the current epidemic of obesity, it should be it is so fascinating that we apparently have another type of fat that if you activate it, you can increase your metabolism. So we have done a lot of studies where we cold expose people, and we really see that when you expose people to cold, that their metabolism increases and that also their brown fat gets activated. And we estimate that when you activate your brown fat maximally, that you can approximately burn 200 to 300 kilocalories per day extra. But well, you can imagine, of course, that when it is day after day after day, that can really have an impact. So we also know from studies that when people sitting in a room for 2 hours per day of about 16 degrees, which is not even that cold, they can lose a bit of fat mass already after 6 weeks. So one of the ways by which you can activate your brown fat yourself is to turn down the heater at home, or to exercise outside in the cold. And there are also certain foods that can activate your brown fat. For instance, in red peppers, there is the substance capsaicin. And this can also activate your brown fat. And possibly that is the cause that you feel so heat after you have eaten.
Right, yeah.
A hot pepper.
Hot pepper, okay. Are there any other foods?
Well, there are some studies suggesting that coffee also activates your brown fat. Yeah, and possibly many more to discover.
And with those studies that you performed yourself, how long were you cold exposing people, and what mechanisms were you using to cold expose them?
Well, what we usually cold expose people for 2 hours before they undergo the PET scan I told about. Mm. And we use cooling blankets that are also used at the intensive care to cool down people. So people are sort of sandwiched between mattresses between these mattresses, cold water is flowing. With that method, it's really cold.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't sound very comfortable.
A really strong stimulus to activate brown fat. Yeah.
I've also heard, and you may have come across this through your PhD as well, that cyclists tend to have more brown fat as well. Is there a particular reason as to why that's the case?
Well, in humans, we are not really sure whether exercise increases your brown fat. In mice, it seems so. In mice, we know that the brown fat, when mice exercise, the muscles make certain hormones, and these hormones can activate brown fat. In humans, it's more difficult. There have been studies in which humans had to do an exercise intervention for several weeks. But the difficult part is that when you do a lot of exercise, your body composition changes. You get less subcutaneous fat, you get more muscle, and that changes the whole way by which your body produces heat. So what we basically see is that people who exercise a lot tend to have a little less brown fat, because they have so much muscle that they, possibly therefore they don't need their brown fat so much. So we are not sure yet.
That's super exciting to know. And I guess, a little bit of cold exposure by not wearing your coat and going out for a quick walk couldn't be a bad thing.
No, and the other thing is cold exposure does a lot more beneficial, has a lot of more beneficial effects. Not only does it activate brown fat, but also when the cold exposure is to such an extent that you shiver a bit, you also have a lot of muscle activity, of course. And there has been a very nice study several years ago from a Dutch group in Maastricht, in which they showed that when patients with type 2 diabetes were sitting in a cold room for 6 hours per day for 10 days, their glucose metabolism improved to a very large extent.
Wow.
Some patients even could halve the amount of insulin after only 10 days. And that's likely part because the muscle really contributes, of course, to uptake of glucose. We have a lot of muscle. So that's also one of the beneficial effects of cold beyond brown fat.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I guess, all these different factors can contribute to a better regulation of our weight overall, right? So a bit of exercise, standing desks, cold exposure, fidgeting, some of the things that you mentioned in the book as well as a healthy diet. You know, if you're shaving off like a bit of energy every cumulatively, you can see why that would result in quite drastic changes.
On the long term, that can really have an impact. So there's also, but Lisbeth can tell more about that, there was a very interesting study about why we should not sit so much. Maybe Lisbeth can tell more about that. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, actually, we often talk about, okay, we should exercise every day, resistance training and cardio exercise. But next to that, it's a separate risk factor for cardiovascular disease and weight gain is, of course, sitting too much. And it's actually not so new. Why is this sedentary lifestyle also so bad, actually? And I think a couple of years ago, indeed, in mice, there was a very interesting study and has been confirmed in humans very recently, is that that somehow in our body there are now indications that we have what they call a graphitostat, which is regulation of our body weight by a sensor in the bone cells of the legs. And we until a couple of years ago, we thought only leptin is the only marker of the amount of fat we have in the body that signals to the brain. And if there is a lot of leptin, then it signals to the brain, okay, decrease your food intake, increase metabolism. Problem in obesity is that people are resistant for that leptin and this whole system is being disturbed. It's not working properly. But now, next to the leptin system, there's another system being detected. That in the bone cells there seems to be a sensor and that like seems to be a weight scale to detecting how much we weigh, and that communicates to our brain. And if we are, for example, very heavy, it communicates to our brain, okay, decrease food intake, increase metabolism. And with this hypothesis, what they detected in mice research a couple of years ago was in last year, it was described by Olsen and colleagues that they performed a research with 69 persons with obesity, body mass index between 30 and 35. And they gave them, they split the group in two, and one group has to carry a vest, which was about 11% of their body weight, so the heavy vest, and the other half of the group was carrying a sort of placebo vest with only 1% of their body weight. They carried it for 3 weeks long, 8 hours a day. I think what was very interesting is after this time, there was more weight loss in the group with the heavy fast. And particularly, they lost more body fat, purely body fat, and they kept their muscle mass intact. And that's important because we don't want to lose weight. If you have obesity, you don't want to lose weight. You want to lose fat and you want to keep your muscle mass because that protects you from weight regain on the long term. So from these experiments, they concluded that also in humans is probably we have such a weight scale in the bone cells of the legs. And that could also maybe explain that when we sit all day, then this weight scale in the legs is sort of tricked. It's thinking we are too light, we are not heavy enough. We have to increase food intake and to decrease our metabolism as a protective mechanism. So that might be an explanation. I think of this. This research is of major importance, and we will hear about it more. And maybe in the future, one of the ways to lose weight would be to carry a couple of hours a day a vest. Of course, don't do it yet because we have to. It should be studied whether you don't have too much weight in your get pain in your shoulders or anything. But this is one of the healthy ways of losing weight, because losing weight, what we see now in our patients in the office, it's really hard, and because this body has become reprogrammed, so we need all these alternative mechanisms to lose weight. Maybe if we talk about also this how to lose weight, I think it's always important when we look at a patient, what are all the factors which had contributed also to the weight gain? Because we often assume it's only unhealthy lifestyle, and yes, it's a lot of the times it's a really important cause, but basically there are six categories of contributing factors or causes of obesity. So lifestyle is one of it, but then we have also mental causes like chronic stress or depression or psychotrauma. We have medication-related obesity. We found in a study that about half of the patients we saw in our obesity center was using at least one or more medications with a potential side effect of weight gain. Some are very common medication like antidepressants, antihypertensives, anti-diabetic medication, or corticosteroids, for example, are widely used. And so that's category three. Category four is hormonal causes like hypothyroidism, polycystic ovarian syndrome, or more rare things exist. And then you have category five and six, and it's more rare, like hypothalamic causes. People are very hungry because their hypothalamus is being disturbed. That's a rare cause. And then the monogenic or syndromic obesity. And we thought that would be also very rare. But what we notice now, if you do proper research and you do proper diagnostics in the office, that we found in obesity centers, 4 to maybe even 8, 9% of the people have a mutation in an obesity gene. So one obesity gene, which can directly lead to obesity. For example, a person who has a defect in the leptin signaling system, they have increased hunger from early age on, so they have early onset obesity, very hungry, and most of the time they're the only one in the family. They have they are a striking weight difference with family members. That's the alarm symptom. And if you look at all these causes, then you can be much more effective with your therapy, because sometimes when a person has a genetic obesity, then you need medication. If it's lifestyle obesity, you need lifestyle intervention, and only if it's not effective, then you need pharmacotherapy or bariatric surgery to be really effective. But when someone has a psychotrauma, for example, you need sometimes psychotherapy. And when you use medication with a weight gaining side effect, you need try to optimize the therapy. And sometimes you can taper down together with a physician. Patients should never do that alone. But sometimes you can replace medication or you can taper down medication. And then all kinds of therapies for obesity will be much more effective than when you do it when you're still having three medications inducing weight gain. So there's so many ways we can do better in treating people with obesity, because if we really want to combat obesity, we should do better treatments and of course the prevention. So now basically the water tap is open and the bath is full, and we should close the water tap so to prevent more people developing overweight or obesity. So healthy food environment, healthy supermarket, healthy schools, exercise, all that. And at the same time, the people who already have obesity, so the bath is full, to unplug the bath and to treat well with combined lifestyle intervention and, if necessary, pharmacotherapy or a bariatric surgery. So weight-reducing medication is often also indicated, but often not reimbursed, which is not a good thing right now.
Absolutely. There's so much I want to unpack there. So we started off with the incredible research around sensors in bone cells and how they can contribute to appetite regulation and metabolism as well, I think, which is super, super interesting. And then I guess one thing to take from that is, you know, standing, trying to be less sedentary anyway, we know has positive effects, and that might explain one of the mechanisms behind why that is the case as well. So again, an additional contributory factor. And then one of the things I wanted to unpack was the genomic component. And I think traditionally, certainly myself, I would have thought that would have been a minority reason as to why people are putting on weight so drastically. But I guess, you know, if it's 4 to 9% of people who have a gene variant that puts them at higher risk of weight gain, that's, you know, 1 in 20, 1 in 15.
We actually don't know at population level, because most of the obesity centers are not studying how not looking for the genetic variants. But when we looked at people who were seeking help in obesity centers, so that might be a selection of the people with the highest BMIs, though, they at least were struggling with obesity from the several centers in the Netherlands. And we studied 1,230 patients. And from that group, we found 4 to even maybe 9% having such a mutation. So that was rather impressive. So to detect it, just ask the questions. When did the obesity occur? Was it at early childhood or was it on a later age? So when it was early, it's more suspicious for it. Is there a normal feelings of satiety? Are you normally feeling full or are you never feeling full or are you increased hungry? That's an alarm symptom, and striking weight difference with the family members. Because when everybody in the family is obese, then it's more often either polygenetic risk that's more normal, like we all have, or it's food environment or exercise environment, environmental factors, for example. That's most common.
Yeah, that is a really good way of structuring it as well. And I guess it brings me to a question about how we measure and monitor weight in general, because right now we use BMI as a crude measure in general practice in the UK. It's falling out of favor, but really we should be looking at body composition. Are there ways in which you think we could use body composition measures in a more effective way that can scale across healthcare services?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem you're addressing right now. We had some discussions with it also at Europe level last week about this. And BMI is an easy measure, but really not good at a positive marker, as you suggest. And a simple way which could be applied in clinical practice would to add the weight circumference, at least. Of course, there are more sophisticated methods like using a DEXA scan or other scans, but it's too expensive to do on a population level. So to use the waist would be important. And of course, also look at all the comorbidities, like is there a high blood pressure? Is the cholesterol levels high? How's the insulin and glucose regulation? Because those are also symptoms of too much fat.
You mentioned these six categories as to why people put on weight. One of them I wanted to talk about was the biological effect. So the biological clock and fat and how that influences appetite and sugar regulation. Maria, is that something you could talk about?
Yeah, well, indeed, the biological clock. So every body cell basically has its own little biological clock. We have a central biological clock in our brain that, well, is sort of the boss on all the little biological clocks in our other cells. And there's a very clear rhythm within our body. This is dictated by the fact when it gets light and when it gets dark again. So by the eyes, the light can tell the biological clock in our brain whether it is day or whether it is night. So you can imagine that when it is day, we are more active. When it is night, we are sleeping. When it is day, certain processes should be very efficient because we are moving a lot. We are seeking for food. We are processing food. And during the night, we are sleeping. We should digest our food, etc. You can imagine that when you turn around this rhythm by, for instance, doing night shifts, you can disturb this very well performed rhythm in our body. And that's also what we see in practice, that people who do a lot of night shifts, they are generally fatter. They have more type 2 diabetes. There are also some very nice epidemiological studies. For instance, a very large study that showed that when you leave on a light in your room at night, that you are a bit fatter as well. So this biological clock is very important. And you can also disturb that, it seems, by eating at the wrong time points. So, of course, our body, when you get up, you start eating, of course, but when you eat during the whole day and also during the night, some people do that can also disturb the little clocks. And for example, your pancreas has to secrete insulin all the time. It can disturb your muscle, of course. And that seems to be also important. And what's also, I think, something that should not be underestimated is sleep quality. Well, I know from my own experience, actually, how killing it can be if you are sleep deprived, for instance, when you have little children. This can be harsh. I think everybody can relate to mentally, but it can also make you more fat, because we know, for instance, again, from epidemiological studies, that people who have fewer hours of sleep are more likely to have obesity, diabetes, and also cardiovascular diseases. And this is already seen even with sleep duration shorter than 6 or 7 hours. We also know from studies that already one night of disturbed sleep, it makes you very hungry, and it makes you also crave for more unhealthy foods during the next day. So that can also result in more weight gain.
This is something that really interests me, because I'm fascinated by healthcare professionals' environment and how they have a propensity to be of a higher weight than people who don't work in the healthcare profession. And I believe it's a lot to do with A, sleep patterns and shift patterns, but also the food environment in which we operate. Because I don't know what it's like in Rotterdam, but we only have vending machines available to us in the middle of the night. We don't really have healthier options in the hospital environment, which needs to change regardless. But I think these are all things that are contributing to that. And this just adds more evidence to it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that some of the things that people, also healthcare workers working in night shifts, that they, these vending machines with unhealthy food, it's really deleterious. Of course, you want to maybe to help them that there is some extra food available. But I think it's so necessary to have healthy food in there, because also recently new studies came out. For example, if you eat your evening meal, your dinner, not at 6 or 7 o'clock, but or 10 or 11 o'clock, that there's major difference in the glucose tolerance afterwards during night, in all kinds of mechanisms are starting in the body, which are making you more prone to gain weight. And if you're already sleep deprived and you eat at the wrong moment, it's sort of a double hit. The sleep deprivation dysregulates your hunger hormones, just as Mariette mentioned, increased ghrelin, decreased leptin, but also your stress system activates, or more cortisol, so you're more longing for high caloric foods, more abdominal obesity can occur, all these tiny things. And of course, one time might not be the difference, but if you have continuous night shifts or work often late, or you just eat later, too late at night. If a lot of people ask about fasting, should I do intermittent fasting? And well, there are many types of intermittent fasting, for example, but the best would be to eat in the morning well and not at night. So if you would like to fast, do it after, take an early dinner and fast afterwards, evening and night. If you do that, you will be fine. You don't have to deal with all kinds of weird schedules, probably. Of course, we need more longer term studies, but to adjust to the natural biological clock is important.
Agreed. Yeah. Professor, I know that you've got an international meeting after this, so I want to be quite mindful of your time. But I did want to ask you about two things actually that I thought were fascinating in the book. There's one you've already alluded to, the hidden weight contributors, particularly medications that we use in the category of immune modulators, prednisolone, inhalers as well as the other medications that could also contribute that people wouldn't really think about. And then I have to ask you about viruses and obesity, because I that kind of blew my mind about this adenovirus potentially being one of the reasons as to why people put on weight as well. But why do we start with the hidden weight contributors in the form of medications?
Yeah, I think that's probably something we need a lot to know a lot more about, because what we see is that many people are using medication, especially people with obesity, And for example, the corticosteroids is one of the group which can be really, we know if you use high dose of prednisone, and most people know, well, that's a sister actually of your stress hormone cortisol. So it's like if you use 20-fold or 30-fold of your stress hormone cortisol, you can imagine that your weight will increase, especially abdominal fat will increase, and all the negative side effects with respect to cardiometabolic factors, cholesterol, insulin, mood disorders can occur. But it's a long-term high dose. We didn't know what will happen with just lower dosages, for example, and if you use that for a long time. And more relations seem to be existing between, for example, use of inhalation medication and obesity. We don't know yet whether it's causally related. It's important to stress because those are association studies. But we found in really large studies now that males and females who were using, for example, nasal sprays with corticosteroids or inhalation medication, for example, for asthma, they had an increased BMI, a little bit higher BMI, but also a little bit higher waist circumference. And important is what another study showed, that people with obesity, that half of them, and with obesity and asthma, for example, that half of the people don't have the allergic asthma, but they have more an asthma-like symptoms which are obesity-related. So you can actually question whether this corticosteroid use is necessary. And in those cases, we always discuss with your pulmonologist or your GP whether it has to be in lung function test. Is it really an allergic asthma? Do you really need a corticosteroid? If yes, you should continue. And sometimes the dosage can be tapered. But also, if it's not, sometimes it can be stopped. And it might be beneficial for weight. We don't know yet, but there are more and more indications suggesting that. So never stop on your own, of course. Always discuss with your doctor. And this applies to more, we found in people with obesity, for example, 27% is using corticosteroids in any way. And we had some examples also in our clinic. For example, I had a man who was using corticosteroids cream, but really large dosages on his whole body for a very severe eczema. And actually he was gaining weight, 30 kilograms in 1 year time, and he was living a healthy life. And I remember when he came into the office and his wife really confirmed, well, I'm cooking healthy every day and we are walking every day. How come he's gaining 30 kilograms again in 1 year time? And then when I talked to his dermatologist and we replaced the creams by weight neutral creams, actually his weight 35 kilograms decreased with the same healthy lifestyle. His mood improved. That was really impressive. And the strange thing was actually also his skin disease was improving somehow. So it's sometimes really good to take out people from this vicious circle to see what are all the contributing factors. And not always it's, of course, medication. And sometimes it cannot be stopped, like, for example, antipsychotic medication. But we should have attention that if there's a weight gaining side effect, that we help people to live healthy lives, to start a lifestyle intervention, and if that's not enough, to administer, for example, anti-obesity medication, because it's so important for all the other diseases which can occur due to the obesity later on. And medication is a serious factor in that. And to be effective, it's good to have a screen before referring a person to a lifestyle intervention or other therapies. Is there which medication is potentially contributing to your weight gain?
Yeah, that's a fascinating anecdote. Actually, I think again it speaks to the complexity of why people put on weight, why people suffer with disease as well. And I think there's definitely a lot of overlap between a healthy lifestyle and improvements across a number of different areas of medicine and health. Like I alluded to, the other sort of hidden contributors to weight, one of them I remember reading was about products in our food, so plastics, endocrine disrupting chemicals, things that I haven't really looked at in much depth, I'll be honest. We are getting an epidemiologist actually to talk about the impact of plastics
on general well-being, but with particular reference to obesity, I understand that some of them do contribute to insulin resistance. Is that something you've come across, Marriott?
Well, yeah. Indeed, it seems that certain components from plastics end up in our food. We ingest it, and it could affect our body fat. We know most from mouse studies, to be honest, and we know that these plastic components, for example, BPA, it can also end up in our fat and somehow changes the way that fat is stored, that it makes the fat more prone to store the fat. And it may also influence our appetite, as is shown in mouse studies. In humans, we do know that these BPAs can enter, can end up in our body fat. We know that from biopsies, and that it is found more in fat from people with obesity compared to lean people. But we are not sure whether this is a causal relationship, of course. It can also be, well, people who are living with obesity, they do have larger fat cells. We don't know if it's causal yet. But to be sure, and I think we should be glad about that, of course, we should be careful about that. And there are certain regulations now, so we don't take any risks.
Yeah, agreed. And the adenovirus.
That is very fascinating as well. Well, also that is mostly associated from the study. So you are referring to the adenovirus 36. We do know that in that about a third of the people with obesity have this virus, while only about 10% of lean people have this virus. So you can think, well, maybe having this virus could have contributed to part of the obesity. Of course, we don't know the causal relationship in humans. This is at least a fascinating discovery. What we do know is that you infect chicken, for example, or monkeys with this virus, they gain a lot of weight. Mm. And we are not really sure how. It also seems that the fat tissue of these animals are more prone to store the fat. It doesn't seem that there are effects on metabolism or on appetite. So this is this should be further discovered. But it's a fascinating discovery indeed.
Yeah, and actually a vaccine now is being developed for this potentially fattening adenovirus 36 to help prevent obesity. So maybe that's something we will hear more about in the future.
Wow. That's definitely one to watch. And I think the potential for vaccine technology in obesity is very, very exciting. I want to ask you about new developments. But before, I was really... really impressed that you talked about fat shaming and the other psychological consequences of weight in the healthcare industry and how there are disparities in access to healthcare. Can you speak to a bit about that in terms of what we see from people whose experiences of healthcare have been poor as a result of the way they look?
Yeah, well, in general, so... maybe it's good to mention what fat shaming is. So it means that people think that people with obesity are less capable of performing a good job, that they are dumber, that they have less willpower, for instance. I think it is very clear from what we told during this podcast that since obesity is so complicated, this is, of course, far from the case. But what is really striking to us is that this fat shaming not only happens in the, well, I call it general public, but it also happens in healthcare. And I think that is because of a lack of knowledge on the complexity of obesity. Maybe it's not really that they have bad intentions, but it's just that a lack of knowledge. So we know that people who work in healthcare also tend to believe that obesity is someone's own fault and that they just should eat less and should exercise more. And that is frequently the advice that is given to patients who seek help when they have obesity. I even know a patient who was told by her doctor to lose weight before getting a large surgery. But the reason she became obese was because of the corticosteroids that the same doctor prescribed. And that really, that was really harsh for her. And I think that another problem is also in healthcare that certain diseases are not always properly identified in people with obesity. So certain complaints, it is easily said, well, it's probably because of the obesity, and that they are, well, that they get less good care as a consequence of that.
Yeah, I feel like we've come full circle in our conversation about the way we treat people who look a different way, who are overweight, in terms of how it was traditionally seen as something that was respectable and something that is aspirational, to now something that is demonized and can actually be at the detriment of people's healthcare access. Your book goes into so much more detail, and you go into patient stories, and you know, we've really just scratched the surface, even though we've ticked off so many different subject matters today, and you go into a bit more of the lifestyle elements as well. But I wonder if there are any new developments that you wanted to mention that you didn't put in the book because of time constraints.
We mentioned some already during the podcast. For example, the study on the weight scale on the legs was briefly in the book also mentioned in mice, but it has been detected in humans, for example.
Epic. We will save some, of course, for possibly for our next book.
Oh, epic. Yeah, no, I'd love to see that. I wonder what the sequel would be called.
I think every day there are new developments, and we're following the literature literally very much for our patients, but also for the science we're performing, but also for the society roles we fulfill. So we are keeping up with the science, and we are indeed intending to write a second book on it.
Amazing, amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for the work that you guys are doing. It's super important, and you know, you're heightening people's awareness of just how complicated this issue is, and it's not as simple as calories in, calories out, you know, exercise more, eat less, and it's, you know, your research that is really driving forward a greater understanding of this complex disease, and it is certainly a disease. So thank you so much for your work and your time today.
You're very welcome. It was lovely to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for the nice question. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. You can find all of the resources and links to their incredible book on thedoctorskitchen.com/podcast. Do sign up to the newsletter, where I share something to eat, read, or listen to every single week to help you live a healthier, happier life. And I will see you here next time.